highs tomorrow night with a low around 25 degrees. Mostly sunny skies Wednesday, the high 45. Mostly clear Wednesday night with a low around 28. Thursday through Friday, we're expecting partly cloudy skies, the high around 50, the low around 32 degrees. 33 at Bloomington and Danville, we have 36 degrees, 37 in Decatur, and 35 degrees on French Plaza in Urbana.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 1240. Among the difficult decisions facing President Obama is whether to give the go-ahead for the controversial Keystone XL oil pipeline. It would bring oil from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. Environmentalists want it blocked. Oil companies and their supporters say it's in the national interest. Renee Montaigne talks to Sarah Ladislaw of the Center of Strategic and International Studies about the prospects for this controversial energy project.
How important is the Keystone Pipeline to the country's future for energy security?
It's a really hard question to answer because there's a variety of perspectives involved, right? I mean, if you're an oil sands producer in Canada, then you obviously think it's fairly necessary to have this infrastructure to be able to get your product to market. If you're a refiner in the Gulf Coast of the United States, you probably think it's good to be able to get the right kind of crude into your refineries so that you can sell it not only here but on global markets. If you're an environmentalist or someone who supports a transition to a lower carbon energy profile in the United States, you probably think it works contrary to what you think is actually in the ultimate best interest of the country.
What was the problem or danger environmentalists saw in the Keystone Pipeline?
It basically makes it possible for larger amounts of Canadian oil sands, which emit more CO2 and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than conventional-based energy sources. The second kind of environmental opposition that they have is that it's a major pipeline that would be going through huge portions of the United States, some environmentally sensitive. But that larger question of whether or not it's sort of in our longer-term national interest to be perpetuating the production of this relatively abundant and relatively close by oil resource rather than promoting things like clean energy is really sort of at the heart of the controversy.
Put this controversy into another context for us, because the Keystone is part of a broader and a dramatic change in the North American energy industry. What is that change?
In the United States, we've now found that it is economically feasible and profitable to produce unconventional oil resources in a number of parts of the country, in addition to unconventional gas. So what we've done is essentially flipped this scarcity mindset in North America that we don't have enough energy resources to one where we actually are quite abundant in these energy resources.
I'm curious about one thing. If this pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline, is approved, oil will find its way down to the Gulf Coast. It will be processed there. And one might think then that would bring up the level of oil available in America. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
It's actually a much more complicated answer than that. And so if you want to just sort of track a barrel from when it's produced to when it actually makes it into your car, per se, or into your heating fuel for your home, you have to go through a number of processes. And one of those is being transported through a pipeline, and the other is being refined in a refinery. And oil is made into a whole host of products. A lot of the gasoline that's made from this oil could stay in the United States, and a lot of the diesel could be shipped to Europe. That's been sort of the pattern of how we, you know, produce and sell the products here. The other issue is that there is currently sort of an oversupply of oil within the mid-continent of the United States. And so a lot of what this pipeline does, it allows some of the heavier crude, which is the oil sands, to come down to the Gulf Coast, and a lot of the lighter crudes to go into the mid-continent. So whether or not an actual Canadian barrel that goes through the Keystone Pipeline in its entirety is consumed in the United States, you can't, it won't be.
There are those in the oil industry who think, for all the controversy, that President Obama will in fact approve the pipeline and will use as his reason that it's in the national interest.
I do think that'll approve the pipeline for two reasons. One, you know, because he'd have to find a reason why it's against the national interest. And for a country that doesn't have an overarching climate policy in and of itself, it's hard to say because we believe in reducing emissions, we don't necessarily want to be importing, you know, a higher emission fuel. And the second being that this has become sort of a political lightning rod to sort of exemplify the debate between pro-oil and gas people and anti-oil and gas people in this country. And it's not the most effective way of debating those issues. And so politically, it would be good to get beyond it and get on to a lot of the other things that the president will have to sort of debate within energy policy.
Sarah Ladislaw is a senior fellow and co-director of the Energy and National Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's 12:45. Anybody want a carrot? In Spain, carrots are being sold in place of theater tickets as a way to avoid a 21% tax on the tickets. Many Spaniards say the carrot rebellion is a creative response to the county's unpopular austerity measures, but some call it simple tax evasion. Reporter Lauren Flair has this story.
When the Spanish government hiked sales tax on theater tickets this past summer, Kim Marseille thought his theater was doomed. With one in four locals unemployed, Marseille knew that even a modest hike in ticket prices might leave the 300-seat Bescano Theater empty.
Nosotros decimos, esto es el final del teatro.
We said, this is the end of our theater and many others. But then, the next morning, I thought, we've got to do something so that we don't pay this 21% and we pay something more fair.
He looked out his window at farmland that surrounds this village 2 hours north of Barcelona and suddenly had an idea. Instead of selling tickets to his shows, he'd sell carrots instead.
Nosotros venderemos una zanahoria.
We sell one carrot, which costs 13 euros. Very expensive for a carrot. But then we give away admissions to our show for free. So we end up paying 4% tax on the carrot rather than 21%, which is the government's new tax rate for theater tickets.
Classified as a staple, carrots were spared new tax hikes that went into effect here September 1st. The highest value-added tax rate on things like cars and clothing went from 18 to 21%. Sales tax on movie and theater tickets jumped from 8 to 21%. Such tax increases have sent tens of thousands of Spaniards into the streets to protest every weekend since the new rates took effect. Pilar Baye is a civil servant in Bescano who traveled to Barcelona to take part in protests. She also bought a ticket, or rather a carrot, for a performance this month.
Pues me parece muy bien.
It seems to me like a good idea, because culture shouldn't be taxed so much. Culture should be accessible to all the people.
Spanish media have dubbed this the Carrot Rebellion, and the Bescano Theater has won kudos from arts advocates nationwide. Shows are sold out, but the theater must also follow the law, says economist Fernando Fernandez at Madrid's IE Business School.
This is called tax evasion. I mean, we may like it because it has to do with culture, and we like people going to the theater. But this is called tax evasion.
The Spanish government says tax hikes are necessary to avoid an EU bailout. But Fernandez says that if some people don't pay what they owe,
this makes people who pay taxes have to pay a larger tax. And this makes more difficult to get the fiscal target. So we have to denounce this just as much as we denounce, you know, the filthy rich who don't want to pay taxes. We should do the same.
Marseille, the theater director, consulted a lawyer and got approval from the mayor for his carrot sales. Many Spaniards think the carrot rebellion is pretty clever, and Marseille acknowledges playing up all the humor in this.
Siempre hay una grabación antes de empezar que decimos.
There's always an announcement before the show begins that says photos are not permitted and that you should turn off your cell phone. So now we're going to add no chomping loudly on your carrots during the show.
He's a little worried the government might ban carrots at theaters, but dozens of foods are considered staples and taxed at only 4%. So if that happens, Marseille says he might switch to selling tomatoes instead. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
And here is the writer's almanac for Monday. It's the 12th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of DeWitt Wallace, St. Paul, Minnesota, 1889. His father taught Greek and Old English at McAllister College. But the son rebelled against him. He became a businessman instead, worked for a publishing house that specialized in agricultural textbooks. Enlisted in the Army for World War I, was seriously wounded. During his recovery, he read hundreds of magazines and realized that a pocket-sized magazine full of condensed general interest articles from other magazines could be a hit. And with that idea, he compiled a sample issue of the first Reader's Digest. First issue came out February 1922, and by the end of the decade, Reader's Digest went on to become the most successful magazine of all time. And it was on this day in 1954, Ellis Island formally closed its doors. It had processed more than 12 million immigrants to the United States in more than a half century of service. The first and second class passengers who arrived in this country, they did not go to Ellis Island. They were given just a brief inspection on board, check for any obvious disease. It was the poorer third class and steerage passengers who were ferried to the island. And immigration officials observed them as they climbed the staircase into the main hall. They put a little chalk on the coats of those they thought might be sick. But if you were in good health and your story checked out, processing might take only about 5 hours. In 1907, more than a million people passed through Ellis Island. But then, around the time of World War I, immigration from Europe began to slow down. Ellis Island was made into a detention center for suspected enemies, and it was closed on this day in 1954. Ellis Island sat abandoned for 30 years, and in 1984, they began restoration. Almost 40% of Americans can trace their ancestry through the gates of Ellis Island. Here's a poem for today by Joan I. Siegel entitled Night School for My Grandmother. In a classroom like this one, where her children once sat fidgeting for the bell to ring so they could grab their jackets and shout to the cold air and sun shining on Broadway, 2 blocks from home, where 2 flights up she had set out bread and milk on the kitchen table because she was down the street at the tailor's shop turning a shirt collar or mending a man's coat, and nights she got down on her hands and knees to wash floors in an office building on 2nd Avenue, things she had learned as a girl in Poland and brought with her a boat ride away to Ellis Island, to the man she married, and soon enough, their 4 children, 1 dead,